to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman.
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Jamie, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It is so wonderful to have you here today. Today, I have a very special guest with me. Dr. Thomas Hemingway is a holistic and integrative medical doctor who lives and shares his philosophy of prevention over prescription. He's passionate about natural health and healing through simple yet powerful daily practices, which can be life-saving. He has an upcoming book, Preventable, 5 Powerful Practices to Avoid Disease and Build Unshakable Health. It describes the foundational principles of creating solid, lifelong health. He also loves sharing his message with his top-rated health podcast, Modern Medicine Movement. You guys can go check out my episode over there, where he's known for distilling down the latest medical knowledge and science into easily digestible, actionable steps which can change our lives in the present and the future. He's also a husband and proud father to 6 wonderful humans with whom he enjoys spending time in the outdoors, surfing, snowboarding, skiing, hiking, skateboarding, playing in the mountains, playing tennis. I think I want to be your kid. He has a goal of saving 100 million lives by optimizing health and wellness through natural means. Dr. Thomas Hemingway, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Oh my gosh, good morning and aloha, Dr. Jamie. How are you?
I'm so wonderful. And actually, I'm leaving shortly for Hawaii. We're heading to Maui for spring break. So I'm going to need all the tips
when we get Maui, off. Yeah. Maui is amazing. Yeah. Any place in Hawaii is amazing. You know that. And what a wonderful time to be there too. Spring break. It's not too hot yet. So you're going to enjoy it. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. Tell us how you ever ended up in Hawaii. I mean, tell us your story.
Oh, geez. So, okay, here it is. So I grew up in California, and somehow, some way, I started surfing at a young age, which over there is kind of hard to do because the water is really cold. In fact, it's where I grew up, 48 to 54 degrees.
How is really cold? What is it?
Oh, so 48 to 54. So summertime, it's a balmy 54. Winter, it's like 48 to 50. And this is where we did every morning the cold plunge, right? Most people set their cold plunge somewhere in that neighborhood. We didn't even know about a cold plunge. Nobody ever heard of that. We were getting ice cream headaches every morning. We were doing this thing just because we loved to surf, but it was really, really cold. And so my dream was to always go to Hawaii and, of course, surf the big waves of the North Shore, right? Pipeline, sunset, all these amazing places I'd seen in the magazines, heard about. And so that's what I did. I applied to some schools in Hawaii, got accepted, and the rest is history. I spent 4 years in Hawaii, graduated actually on Oahu, on the North Shore of Oahu. There's a small little campus called BYU Hawaii, and it's only 8 miles from Sunset Beach and Pipeline. So I was living the dream right close to the famous surf breaks I'd always heard about. And then I couldn't resist but to come back. So I did medical school in California, UC San Diego, my residency, UCLA, all the big name places in California, but I was always longing to return. So did that. And we've been nearly, gosh, overall almost 30 years in Hawaii. So it's been an amazing life. It's my kids don't know how, you know, you said I got 6 kids, which is true. And they're all born and raised in Hawaii. They have no idea how blessed and fortunate they are. So it's an incredible spot. I'm so excited for you guys to get back out there. That's awesome.
So what are the age ranges of your kids?
So my oldest 2 are in college and my youngest 2 are in elementary school. So I got the whole gamut. It spreads almost, I think it's 16 plus years across the board. My littlest is 5. And she's what keeps me young right there, Jamie. She is one of these kids that is with endless energy. She bounces off the wall. She's the one that you go, that's the poster child for the metabolism I want. She is nonstop action all day long. And then she crashes hard about 8 o'clock at night. So I think that's a good goal for all of us. Go strong, go hard. And by 8 or 9 at night, hit the sack and wake up early and do it all over again.
So with having such a large age gap in there, you know, 2 in college, 2 little ones in elementary school, tell us what you have learned as a physician and as a parent in that time. Like when your oldest 2 were little, you probably parented, maybe lived a different lifestyle. I don't know. Maybe you've just been doing this great all along. Give us some advice.
Oh, definitely not. I've made all the follies and foibles of every parent. And, you know, when we started with our first, we, you know, like anybody, listened to our pediatrician, right? They're like, okay, so, you know, 6 months, you introduce this stuff called rice cereal. Like, holy crap, that's like the worst quality stuff out there, right? Highly processed, terrible stuff. And then get the juice in there. You got to give your kid apple juice because, you know, that'll help them poop and all this stuff. And like, we are so different now than we were then. But one thing we, besides the health stuff, you know, what to eat, the real single ingredient food and all that good stuff, is that I think you relax a little bit more. You know, when you're a first time parent, so stressful, you know, they're not sleeping, you're not sleeping. You're like, oh my gosh, you know, are they going to survive if they wake up twice during the night? And now I got different problems, Dr. Jamie. I got my youngest, well, actually my second to youngest, who is just the most beautiful little soul. She's our first girl. So we got four boys in a row and they are all boy, you know, rough and tumble. And then my penultimate child is a girl and she's seven. And she was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes a few months ago. And so last night, I'll be honest, her glucose alarm went off a couple of times and I was waking up for that. So I never knew that, you know, when my kids were well out of diapers, I would still be getting up in the middle of the night. And so I feel all the parents out there, whatever age group your kids are, it's, you know, it's a challenge, but it's amazing. I mean, when you get to hang out with them and do things like you mentioned, I love to do with my kids, whether it be skiing or surfing, snowboarding, mountain biking, whatever it is, just taking a walk with them outside, like connecting with my kids now, I think is so much more critical and vitally important than I realized when I was going through this nearly 20 years ago when I had my first kid. You know, I was doing my first job and I was gone all the time, 100 hours a week, and I didn't know any different. That's just what I was thought I was trained to do. And now, you know, every moment I get to spend with my kids is invaluable. I cherish it. I love to connect with them and just build that relationship. And so, yeah, it's a little different now, but it's always been an amazing road as a parent. Lots of challenges for sure.
Yeah.
But super, super rewarding.
I love it. I love it. My kids are, it's so amazing to watch them develop into these humans and their different personalities and to see little reflections of yourself. And it's really one of the most magical experiences being a parent. I can't lie. There's ups and downs for sure. But okay, so tell us about your early career in medicine. You were an emergency room physician, yeah?
Yeah. So board certified ER doc. You know, I come from that generation that we thought that, you know, the two best shows ever, right, were the original ER with, you know, George Clooney back in the day, and that show Doogie Howser. Like when I was a teenager, I was like, dude, I'm Doogie Howser. You know, I love learning about this stuff and it's so cool. And I'm going to be, you know, the first, well, not really, wouldn't be the first teenage doctor. And I wasn't a doctor in my teens. I went to usual high school, regular college, medical school. So yeah, didn't do the teenage doctor thing, but just being able to be that guy that could kind of be the jack of all trades, that's kind of always been, you know, my approach to things. I literally have a toolbox in every place I go in the world. When I travel with tools. Like,
amazing.
Like
with I'm the not real talking about like medical MacGyver tools.
Yeah, but I'm talking about like regular tools. And I used to travel with like medical tools on an airplane. I'm like, God, I can't be using that stuff on an airplane. Like, come on, you know? So I kind of stopped doing that. But I've always been one of those MacGyver types for sure. One of my favorite shows as well.
So tell us about your experience in the emergency room and how it kind of shaped. Obviously, your thinking patterns are vastly different now than they were when you wanted to become an ER doctor.
Yeah. So, well, it's kind of interesting. So as a young, I would say teen, I had always a very profound curiosity and desire to learn about not just the regular kind of physiology and what makes the body tick and work, so to speak. I always had kind of a open mind as far as health and wellness and even holistic kind of real, you know, kind of natural health. I used to read Deepak Chopra as a kid. So Deepak, you know, I know he's pretty old these days, but I read his book, Quantum Healing, I think when I was 14, and I loved it. I'm like, I want to do this. Like, this is what I want to do. And then, you know, I got influenced by the ER stuff. I'm like, no, this is way more exciting. And and so I spent a couple of decades in the ER. And my last decade, when I was in my 40s, I realized that something is not right here. I'm literally seeing patients younger than myself. And here I was in my 40s. I was seeing men and women alike having first time stroke, first time heart attacks in their 30s, 40s, you know, 50s. When I did my training, these were all 60 and 70 year olds. I'm thinking, what in the world is going on? These people have young kids. They're having heart attacks. They're dying sometimes, sadly, from sudden cardiac death. And they're younger than I am. What is going on here? Something in our society with our healthcare, medicine, wellness, prevention, it's just not working. It's obviously broken. The system is broken. We are not doing our best to prevent these diseases because, as you know, Jamie, heart disease is still today, present day, number one killer in women and men in the whole dang world. I mean, one person in the US alone has a heart attack every 30 some odd seconds, and 700,000 people died in 2020 from heart disease. Like, this is still a big, big problem, and it doesn't have to be. It is largely preventable. So I had this kind of moment where I remember specifically a certain, you know, patient I had that was younger than myself, and he had young kids, and he asked me, "Doc, you know, am I going to live through this? Like, what's going to happen to me?" And it was like a real kind of heart-to-heart moment where I was like, oh my gosh, I got to do more. I love, love, love being in the ER and saving lives and doing all the fun stuff. Like, somebody falls down and dislocates a shoulder, I can pop that back in. Super fun, exciting stuff. But I'm like, I got to do more. I got to help prevent this stuff. So they never land in the ER in the first place. So I kind of took a little career path, you know, change, pivot, you know, really got into the integrative medicine, worked with the Institute for Functional Medicine, did all that. And now I kind of do a hybrid. I still do some work in the ER, but it's not every single day. It's not all the overnights and weekends that I used to do. And I really focus on my kind of holistic integrative practice and try to help people not land in the ER and help them live their fullest, most energetic life and hopefully not die from heart disease, stroke, diabetes, you know, neurodegenerative conditions that are almost all preventable. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of the skills you have as an emergency physician are perishable skills. So it's good to keep those tools sharpened for sure. It probably pays the bills too, while you can really focus on your passion. So
yeah, for sure. And I still enjoy that. You know, when I'm there, I enjoy it, but it's nice to walk away when you're done and you know, not have to go back the next day.
Yes. Yes. Oh, you mean like me? Because I work 365 days.
Yeah, you're always on call. I don't envy that at all.
Yeah, you just never know. Those babies just come wherever. So it's been a busy couple of weeks. Okay, so let's talk about what these kind of foundational principles are that can prevent people from developing things like heart disease. Tell us what the first one is.
Yeah. So let me just spill the beans, you know, give you the quick mnemonic, because as all, you know, previous former medical students, we always like mnemonics. These are memory tools, right? So I developed one to help us remember these five steps, and it's FMSGs, right? Because we all hate MSG anyway, as we should, you know, any processed, highly processed food or ingredient we should hate, but FMSGs. So F is for food. Food is either the best possible medicine, the best sustenance that we can give our body, or it's a slow poison. And we get to decide this every day, multiple times a day. And it's super, super simple. And I like people to remember that we all, especially me, need to add more than subtract from our life this way, because there are literally 300,000 like edible plants, you know, vegetables, fruits, etc., that we could eat as humans. And guess how many we eat, Dr. Jamie, on an average adult in their entire life? Guess how many we eat? What's the number of different foods we eat on average for humans? It's low.
Yeah. I was going to say
200, roughly 200. And about three of those, four, depending on if you want to, four food sources make up 60% of our entire human diet. And this is not surprising, right?
It's the corn,
it's the wheat, soy and rice. Those four things make up over 60% of our diet as humans. And there are hundreds of thousands of foods that we could be eating, you know. And when we look into the fermented foods, for example, there's literally 100,000 different fermented foods out there. Our potential diet is so expansive, and we limit ourselves to only a couple of things. And so I really try to help people realize that there's so much more that we can be eating, and they're all natural things. Like, if we eliminate only three big, sort of the big three, the evil triad, as I sometimes call them, you know, the highly processed sugar, the highly processed grains, and then the seed oils, we eliminate those three, and almost everything else is available to us. If it's real, if it's whole, if it's natural, if it's single ingredient, and we have literally hundreds of thousands of choices. So eat the whole rainbow, right? All the good stuff. Go to Hawaii, go to the farmer's market. I hope you will. There's so many amazing things there. You'll look at this stuff and go, what is that? And they'll say, oh, that's a rambutan, and this is how you eat it, and it's so yummy, or, you know, lychee or lily koi or whatever. There's so much out there. One of my favorite things to do is travel and visit the farmer's market, because that's where it's at. That's what we've been doing forever, right? Just getting our food from the soil of the earth and all natural means, and we will be so much healthier, and it's so much more tasty, actually. So much. Oh, I can't wait. I got to travel again. I can't wait.
You're traveling all the time, right? Between Utah, I do, Hawaii. But, no, you guys, you know, are pretty much in.
Yeah, we're kind of staying put the winter in Utah. My mom is here and she's been ill, but I love to go to other countries, especially the Mediterranean. Their cuisine is amazing. And over there, I actually will have a piece of, you know, sourdough bread. Like over here in the US, I don't eat any bread, like almost ever. It's just hard to get good quality stuff here, right? We use the dwarf wheat. That's so different. It's highly, you know, allergenic. It has really much more gluten in it than the stuff that they have in Europe. And it's just, it's way different. All the ingredients are so, so different over there. And you can actually see your food out in the field, either growing or in pasture, wherever. And here, you know, it's just a lot different. It's a little bit harder. It's still doable to get high quality food, but you definitely have to, you know, make a little bit more of an effort. And so that's why I love to travel, especially places like the Mediterranean, and eat their cuisine. It just makes me happy. I love to eat. I can't help it.
So give us some recommendations on how people should eat. Okay, you've talked about exploring like other foods, but I think it's so confusing, right? You go to Instagram and people are like, eat plant-based, and then you got these carnivore people, and then there's everything in between, and the medical literature says Mediterranean. I can completely understand why it's confusing for people.
So confusing. Oh my gosh. It's tough because there's so many voices out there. So here's the thing. What I like to tell people, which I think is amazing, is that we as humanity, we are all very unique, right? We have folks way up north, the Inuit, that eat basically all fat and meat. That's it. They eat like no vegetables and they're super healthy. They don't have heart disease, at least prior to, you know, the advent of them coming into the rest of the Western world and getting access to some of our poor diets. And then you have other groups that are nearly all vegetarian. And then you have other groups that are somewhere in between. And so we as humans can eat a lot of different things. So what I tell people is there is no one perfect, one size fits all for every single human. But what all humans can do is we can eat real food. And if you're somebody like me that eats everything under the sun, I'm eating a steak for dinner tonight. I actually already have it. It's already being prepped. I'm soaking it right now so I can have it, you know, just real tasty with all the different spices that I like to do and marinate it real well. And I'm also eating Brussels sprouts, like steak and Brussels sprouts. Those are two of my favorite things. I know the carnivores out there are like, why the heck would you eat a vegetable? Vegetables are not for humans. They don't want to be eaten. BS. We've been eating vegetables. We've been eating plants. We've been eating the animals of the field, pasture raised, for literally millennia. We can eat it all, but everybody is a little bit different and we kind of have to tweak it to what helps us thrive. So if you're thriving, keep doing whatever you're doing. But I really think that anybody can benefit from real, whole, and natural food. And I always start my day with protein. And this is what I teach my kids. You know, when you have your first meal at whatever time of the day you have it, and I would recommend you do what works for you because it's different for everybody. I don't wake up hungry. You know, you got me on this morning. It's early. Food is the last thing on my mind right now. You know, I want to get a bunch of stuff done and maybe go for a walk, or maybe, you know, I don't know if I'll wait this long, but I could literally go skiing and then eat afterwards. Like, it's just whatever I feel like in the day, but I start the day with protein. So what that usually is it's a couple of eggs, might be four eggs, might be six if I'm really hungry. I know it sounds crazy, right? All the yolk and the cholesterol. That's okay. We make cholesterol anyway. It's not bad for you. But start it with protein because that will not only satiate you and you won't be craving, you know, that healthy snack, right? The snack bar that you thought was healthy and all those things, the carbohydrates, you won't crave at all. It'll keep you going between meals. I don't snack at all. So I do eat three meals a day, and I didn't used to a couple of years ago. I was big on the intermittent fasting thing and I was down to two meals a day. Sometimes I do the OMAD thing, the one meal a day. And what I've realized is that I personally couldn't get enough protein into my body in one meal a day. It's really hard. Yeah. My goal is 150 grams a day. you try eating 150 grams worth of steak, for example. It's a lot of steak. So I teach my kids just eat real food. One, you know, single ingredient food and all the things, plants, animals, whatever, fish, it's all open game and open season, if you will, if that works for you. And so all diets can be, I think, manipulated in a way that'll work for some people, and you got to pick what's best for you. So if you're vegetarian and thriving, fantastic. If you're carnivore and thriving, fantastic. For me, I don't like to limit myself. I just kind of eat it all as long as it's real and natural food. It makes it super easy too, Jamie. When I travel, I can eat everything except for I avoid the stuff that comes in a bag or in a box or with a barcode that's highly processed. I try to eat almost none of that stuff, but yeah, that's the basic principle. Eat real food and eat to your body's own indicators, right? Your body will tell you if you're hungry and you're kind of, you know, you've taken some time to get away from the processed foods, you'll know when it's the right time to eat. You know, some people are pushing these windows of intermittent fasting to inordinate amounts of times, doing 2 hours a day of eating and 22 hours of no eating. Like, that's okay for once in a while, but that's not okay for everyday use. Like, that's not the way it was meant to be, you know? A lot of nuance to it, a lot of variety, but there's room for everyone. And just eat real food is my first and foremost sort of party line, if you will.
I love that. I love that. Okay, so 88% of our country has metabolic disease. Huge problem.
At least.
Now estimating probably more than 1 in 2 people have prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. Where do you fall with low carb and ketogenic diets?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I actually did keto for nearly 2 years straight. So I've done all the things, you know, and I love low carb, but I'm not extreme anymore. Like I love carbs too, but the carbs that I eat, they're always real fruits and vegetables and lots of the latter. I do like fruit, but some of it, and this is the benefit of our sort of geeky modern life where we can, you know, challenge ourselves with these devices. You know, I got a device here on my wrist. I've done the CGM thing. My daughter has a CGM 24/7 nowadays, for better or for worse, and all of that. So we've got to see how our body responds to different foods. And so what I've realized is that there are certain fruits that will spike my blood sugar, like pineapple, for example. Being from Hawaii, I used to eat pineapple all the time, and I still love pineapple. But now I'm not going to sit down and eat half a pineapple like I used to because it just... my sugar goes through the roof. Or like oatmeal, for example, not the processed stuff, but I'm talking the rolled oats that are steel cut, that are like, they don't even look like oatmeal, right? Like even eating that spikes my blood sugar. So there's certain things that I just don't.
Yeah, mine
really
went over 200
anymore.
With oatmeal. I did an experiment a couple of years ago I did a couple of days of a vegan diet and had a CGM on. I was mind blown. Yeah.
Blown away. Yeah. And so this stuff, you know, when you've experienced it, you're like, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't be eating that. I'm told it's quote unquote healthy, but it doesn't work for me. And that's where the individuality comes in, this sort of precision and personalization of medicine, which is so dang cool. And you just kind of pick what works best for you. And for me, I do love berries, for example. I love blueberries. I love strawberries. I love boysenberries. I love raspberries. And those don't really spike my blood sugar, especially if I'm eating them towards the end of my meal. And that's a little hack here. You know, if you like to have a little sweet treat, you know, whether it be some Greek yogurt with some berries, maybe even some, what I like is this kind of grain-free granola that's all from nuts, and just drizzle a teeny bit of honey. Like, I have a sweet tooth too. Don't get me wrong. I like sweets as well, but I like them naturally. And then I just put it towards the end of the meal. And when I do this, my sugar doesn't spike. And then I go for a walk and it doesn't spike at all. You know, it's amazing. You know, that's little sort of nuance to all of this that we can figure out when we kind of listen to our body. So I still would describe myself as low carb, but I'm definitely not like full on, you know, keto. I'm going to flex my muscle if I can get, you know, my ketones up above 4 or whatever, you know, like, no, like I eat to feel, eat to thriving, eat to energy. And when I was doing like hardcore keto, I mean, you feel like you have all the energy in the world, but I'm just going to be honest. I'm turning 50 next year and I lost weight on keto and I didn't want to lose weight because when I did lose weight, I lost a little bit of muscle mass too, which as you and I know very well, that is the secret to longevity is your muscle mass. That is the secret to metabolism. That is the secret to functionality, longevity. You don't want to be losing your muscle mass. So on full on keto, I lost a little muscle mass. And so I learned that for my body, it's better for me to cycle in and out, and it's better for me to have some carbs. Like the strictly zero carb, hardcore keto guys, that just didn't work for me. I didn't thrive off of that. I mean, I felt like I was pretty good as far as I had energy, but I was noticing, you know, my muscles were shrinking. I was losing weight. It just wasn't for me. So I definitely eat carbs, but I just avoid the highly processed ones. I don't eat any breakfast cereals. I don't eat any breads. I rarely have any kind of dessert. I'll be honest, I do still like ice cream. I rarely have it, but I will have ice cream maybe once a month for a birthday. I mean, I got six kids, so there's at least 8 birthdays over the course of the year. So I got to have ice cream 8 times a year, maybe more.
Yeah, I have I have a great sugar-free ice cream recipe with egg yolks and milk and cream. And yeah, so you can, we bought an ice cream maker during the pandemic. It was like my new hobby. Yeah. So
yay, I'll get that recipe. I love the cream, like creamy stuff. I don't know how people can do non-dairy. My body, thank goodness, tolerates it. And I try to get as raw as I can, but depends on where you are in the world. But I couldn't give up dairy. There's just no way.
My kids' favorite ice cream that I have made, and I use a little bit of allulose in it, or maybe a few drops of stevia or something like that. But it's egg yolks and cream it's maple bacon. So I used real, like, legitimate maple syrup. They do make a monk fruit maple syrup if you want. But anyway, we had the real deal, and then some just like fresh, you know, crumbled bacon on top. And it was, oh my gosh, my kids loved it. So I made lots of different varieties, but that's what they asked for at Christmas time this year. So, let's
so
spin
cool.
into kind of feeding kids. A common question I get, I've only got 3, you got double. Yeah. How do you feed your family? Like, and how do you feed your family on a budget? Because I think there is a perception that healthy food is really expensive.
Yeah. So here's what I do. And actually what's cool is now the data supports us in saying that healthy eating does not have to be more expensive. And what you have to do, which might be a tiny bit more challenging, you got to plan a little bit better. So let me just give you a quick example. Yesterday we went to Costco. Yeah, I do shop at Costco. I do shop at Walmart. I shop at Target. I shop at wherever I can find quality food. And the cool thing is nowadays, even Walmart's got cool stuff. They got some organic stuff. I bought some sausage there. I was surprised at how good the ingredients were. I couldn't find anything bad. It was basically just meat and spices and a little water and vinegar. I'm like, holy crap, even Walmart sells good stuff. So you can get it anywhere. But as, you know, buying for this big family, you got to plan ahead. So what I try to do is keep in mind what are our top meals of the week. I'll be honest, we might be boring in some folks' eyes. We eat about the same 6 or 7 dinners. I'm just speaking to dinner. Every week. We love tacos. You know, we'll do, we have this particular at Costco. I'll just say the name, right? We have that, you know, ground bison that they sell there. We make these bison tacos, which are amazing. We have them at least once a week, sometimes twice a week. We can get wild caught shrimp at Costco. We can get wild caught fish at Costco. So the thing that makes food affordable with a bigger family is you just have to plan your meals. You can't just buy whatever jumps out at you and this and that. And the organic thing, I try hard to only buy organic when it really matters. When you're eating the whole, you know, fruit or the whole vegetable, the skin included, I try to go really strongly with organic. So that's berries, for example. Berries are almost the leading pesticide-laden fruit if you're buying non-organic. So for me, a berry that's not organic, I just don't eat it. I'll leave it at the grocery store. Even if some places they won't even sell organic, it's like, well, I'm skipping the berries today. So there are a couple of lists, and I'm sure your listeners and viewers know this from the EWG.org folks, the Environmental Working Group. It's the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. And you can go and look on those. And basically what it'll tell you is that there are certain things that you can buy that are non-organic that's totally fine. Like, for example, an avocado, right? You're not going to eat the outer peel of an avocado. So if you can save money by buying some of these things that are not organic because you're not eating the peel or the rind or what have you, go for it. But if you're going to eat the whole thing, like a berry, for example, try to really buy organic. And so what I tell people is you got to start slow. Like, you're not going to go from 0 organic to all organic in 1 week, because if you do, you're going to notice the price tag. You're going to go, holy crap, this stuff is, you know, 30% more expensive. I just can't do this. Do it maybe one thing at a time. Every week, try, okay, I'm going to buy this thing organic. And take in mind those lists where you can buy some things that are non-organic. And I think you're always going to win if you buy real food, single ingredient food, you're always going to win. Whether it be the best quality vegetables and fruit that are organic and that are grown by your neighbor and you know where they came from, or the same thing with meat. You know, if you're out in the Midwest someplace and your neighbor is a farmer or they do cattle and they do all pasture raised, you know, they're not feeding them grains and crap at the end with seed oil to fatten them up, you know, go to that guy because you know the source of that. And so just do your best wherever you are, but just buy real food. I think if you're going to just avoid basically the whole center of the grocery store for the most part, you're going to be doing so much better. And it's actually, it's nearly comparable. In our case, like I mentioned, when we first started going solid with the organic and the pasture-raised everything and the regenerative meat and wild-caught everything, it was a little bit of a sticker shock. But as we were able to kind of build some connections with community and farmers markets and local ranchers and things like that, all the beef in Kauai, at least where I live, and in Hawaii, is basically all pasture raised, clean, regenerative. They're not. There's no feedlots over there. So I buy all locally sourced stuff, and it just tickles my heart to know that these are happy cattle that I'm eating. They're literally grazing. I get to see them when I drive to work. They're literally just on, you know, all over the pasture land, and it's great. And so it doesn't have to be prohibitive, but I would just say do it stepwise. Like if you go from zero organic to all organic in a week, you're going to be like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. But just do a little bit at a time. And as you start to limit those processed foods, you'll notice two things. One, like that crap, if I buy a box of cereal, Jamie, in Hawaii, that's $10 for one box of cereal. You know how long a box of cereal would last if we ate that stuff?
So the garbage isn't even cheap.
Yeah, the garbage is not even cheap. So it doesn't have to be expensive. And I've done the comparison. I've certainly done both. And the data actually shows that it's not more expensive, but it does take sometimes a little bit more of the planning. You have to kind of plan out.
Yeah, I mean, it's just changing your patterns, right? It's like most of us probably walk through the grocery store and grab the things we normally grab, and we don't even like, we like the aisles are memorized, right? So like it's just changing, like it's just changing everything about the whole situation. And you know, I think from our perspective, getting our kids to kind of buy into it was more like about education. It was kind of like, okay, like how does this food make us feel? How does that? Because I remember one time my kids went to a movie theater. They ate a bunch of candy and popcorn, all these things. And they were like, oh, my stomach hurts. And I'm like, okay, just remember this, right? Like you put garbage in, you feel like garbage. And, you know, it's like, we don't inherently say like, you know, this food is bad, because I'm going to be completely honest with you guys. Like you said, like I might have some real ice cream sometimes. I might have, you know, this or this or this, but if you're doing 99% of the time, you know, those little types of, I guess we'll call them hormetic stressors, are probably not going to do much damage. But if you're doing those things day in and day out, it definitely is. Are you willing to share with us kind of with your daughter's diabetes diagnosis, like how that has really changed, you know, the family and what you guys are eating and getting her really good control?
Yeah, for sure. And I would just say kids, like you said, if you just kind of talk them through what you're doing, like if you've always, and I was one of those parents, like I literally bought breakfast cereal, like whatever, the Post, the Wheaties, the really crazy stuff, the Fruit Loops, the Lucky Charms. Like I used to buy a giant box of that at Costco. So I'm just like everybody, you know, I've tried all that stuff. My kids have tried all that stuff, but we made some changes about a decade ago. And then even more so, you know, this was just last November, a couple of months ago, she was diagnosed. And so we had to make even further changes. Like we thought we ate pretty healthy, but basically we had to go full on, you know, low carb, zero grains. I mean, pretty much she doesn't do any gluten. We had to, for her, eliminate all dairy and a lot of stuff. So it was really hard. But what was cool is my, you know, the rest of my kids, for the most part, other than my younger daughter, they're older and they're kind of like, oh, that kind of makes sense. Let's try as a family to support our little, you know, Lily is her name, and support her and eat what she's eating. And sometimes they deviate a little bit and it's okay, but we've basically really tried hard to do the single ingredient stuff. Like we're looking at labels, and even she looks at a label and she knows what protein is. She said, Dad, does this have enough protein for me? Are the carbs low enough? And at first it was, you know, really hard for her, because she had like all of us certain preferences. You know, we all have a certain palate that we like, our go-to foods. And, And when you can't eat any gluten, you can't eat any dairy, you're not eating. In fact, for her, we had to limit eggs for a while, kind of do a full-on elimination diet. She couldn't eat literally anything that she wanted. It was really, really hard. But what we did is we went to the store and we looked at all the things she could eat, and we let her kind of help in the choosing. Like, do you want to try this week? Do you want to try that? It was kind of fun. Like, the spin was, I'm going to try something new. And so this was something I would encourage everybody, is literally try something new that's real, that's whole, that's single ingredient every single week. It doesn't have to be hard. Just choose one thing. And if you can get it at the grocery store, fantastic. If you can get it at your farmer's market, your local market, even better. But just add like one new thing every week. And so this is what we did with her, and we're still doing it. We're still finding new things that she can try that are real food. And some of this, like, they do have some decent, you know, it's all going to be kind of processed, right? Anything that comes in a bag or box or with a barcode, like, we've found some keto this and that's that she can eat that she likes, that don't have the glutens, that don't have the highly processed sugars, that use real honey and things like that. So some of that stuff is better quality. So we've taught her how to, you know, figure this stuff out. And it's been actually really fun, because we've actually added, I'll be honest, we've added more than we've subtracted, even with her and all of the limitations that we had to place upon her diet. And I think the whole family has enjoyed it, because we've learned how to make like pizza with chicken. Chicken is the base for the crust. Yeah. Like, who would have thought like I was going to be making pizza with chicken? Because she likes pizza. She's like every other 7-year-old, right? So Friday night, you know, that's tonight, we're going to have movie night, and we'll have pizza that we made ourselves with all real ingredients that has a chicken base for the crust. And Guess what? It tastes great.
It does. Cool. I've made it before. Yeah.
Yeah. It's exciting.
It's super delicious. You can, just like base is the protein, and then you can put all, we've made like taco versions. We've made buffalo chicken. We've done, I mean, a Philly cheesesteak pizza. Like, it's fun sometimes. Yeah. To kind of experiment that. Well, I'm very interested to know, obviously she probably has an endocrinologist, you know, that is her doctor, but you are much smarter and savvier than most parents who are listening now that have a kid with type 1 diabetes. I'm very interested to know, you know, like, what were the recommendations for her, you know, in our traditional model, like how she should manage this, and how have you kind of decided as a parent, you know, what you think is best?
Oh my gosh. This part actually is frankly embarrassing. And this is one of the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing with this sort of, you know, era of my life, is that when we went on our first visit, they basically told us, oh, well, you know, she's going to be stuck with this her entire life. Just get used to it. Doesn't matter what she eats, as long as she covers it with insulin. She, you know, don't take stuff away from her. Let her eat whatever she wants. Like this, it was crazy. From the endocrinologist down, the entire team. And mind you, this is in a big city, super specialized place where they actually have a children's hospital. We went to the, you know, children's clinic with the endocrinologist specialist of the specialists. And they told us basically the worst advice ever. And for me, I was sitting there like I was mind blown. Like, these are people you can't argue with. And you know this well, right? I mean, the specialists, you're going to bring up something contrary, they put you on the blackball list. Oh, we don't want to see these guys again. They're difficult. They're difficult patients. And I'm trying to do what's right for my daughter. I'm trying to get her real, natural, single ingredient food. And the nurse educator is telling me, oh, it doesn't really matter. Let them eat whatever. This is a hard enough diagnosis as it is. Just make sure you cover, you know, count the carbs. You know, you cover with the appropriate dose of insulin. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? Are you insane? Like, do you realize that this is going to make things worse? Talk about juicing up the inflammation that's already going on in her body that may have caused this in the first place. Who the heck knows? But like, why would I put this poison into my kid and then just cover it with insulin? Like, it was the worst advice ever. And I don't know, you know, I'm sure there's better endocrinologists that are sort of integrative and functionally trained. I couldn't find one where we are, and we're in a big city right now. And it's nutty, and it just breaks my heart to think that there's so many other parents out there that are getting really bad advice from medically trained, you know, sort of high profile doctors. And I'll be honest, Dr. Jamie, we went one time, you know, to do the official, you know, first visit. We have not been back. And guess what? Her sugar has been incredible. I mean, she averages right about 100. That's her average.
Wow.
You know, she might spike to 180. Occasionally she'll hit 200, but she's between like 70 and 160 all the time. And she with the worst case scenario. Her hemoglobin A1C was higher than the even lab could measure. It was over 14, which for anybody who knows that is like, holy freak. You know, it's higher than the lab would even assign a number to. And now it's down to, I think, you know, we rechecked it and it was like 7, you know, and coming from over 14 to like 7. And we're just feeding her real food. This is only a matter of 3 months, basically.
Like, in retrospect, did you ever see this coming, or was it really sudden for her?
No, it was caught us blindside. I mean, 100%. It was crazy. We thought either she had cancer or diabetes, because we noticed that she was losing weight and she was having a growth spurt too. She was getting taller. So we rationalize everything. This is what parents do, especially, I don't know, ER doctors do this.
No, the gynecologist.
She's not dying. Okay. She's growing. She's growing, you know, she's getting thinner. But, you know, finally when I was hugging her, I was like, holy crap, I can feel every little rib in your body. Like, something's not right. Yeah, you're a little bit taller, but this is not just thinning out, you know. And she was experiencing more thirst than normal. She was always hungry. And I didn't even take her in. I drove to the nearest pharmacy. I bought the glucometer, you know, the blood sugar device. I pricked her finger, and I'm embarrassed to say that her sugar was over 500. I was like, holy crap. I was like mind blown. I'm like, here I am. I'm the ER doctor, and my daughter's been walking around with the blood sugar over 500 for who knows how long. I mean, it probably wasn't a real long time, but it was at least a few weeks, you know, that she was starting to have some weight loss, and she was thirsty, and she was really hungry. And oh my gosh, mind blown. We were just like, holy crap, what is going on? None of our other, you know, all the kids are perfect health. My grandfather was a type 1 diabetic. And so we do have some family history, but my parents don't have it. You know, my siblings don't have it. So yeah, it was a total shock to us. But the mainstream advice we got at the pediatric endocrinology office was piss poor. I'm sorry to even say that. I don't want to say the name of the clinic to slight them, but it was really embarrassing as a physician.
It's like that across the country. Yeah. I've had, you know, experience with some type 1 patients who have, you know, done more low carb type diets, and it's been incredible to hear their stories about not only just they feel better, but reducing their insulin by about 50%, saving themselves like over $1,000 a month. I'm not buying insulin right now. I'm sure you could weigh in on this. There's a lot of controversy with, you know, the caps on prices. And I mean, for something that literally these patients need to survive.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. Yeah. And I'm at a weird point in my career where I'm not getting health insurance with the ER job that I'm working. And so we're buying everything at literally full price. And it is, we went from like thousands of dollars a month on insulin supplies, you know, just the stinking needles, like all, it's amazing how expensive and the markup. And we've, you know, kind of learned to navigate the system better. There's, you know, lower priced options out there if you look, and it's definitely a challenge. I don't know how anybody could really do it. Like, I mean, like I said, without insurance to be navigating this whole system and having to pay full price for insulin and all of the supplies. And we've put her on, we don't have her on a pump, but we have her on a CGM all the time because it's just more humane for her. We don't have to prick her all the time. I mean, she was getting pricked like 20 times a day, you know, a 7-year-old girl literally getting poked 20 plus times a day. Like, our hearts were just breaking. So we got her on the CGM, which has been amazing. She doesn't have to get, you know, pricked that much for her finger stick. Just occasionally we'll make sure that things are, you know, syncing up, and every 2 weeks we got to change it and make sure everything's working properly. But it's a tough system to navigate. But yeah, I definitely, maybe that'll be my second book. It'll be all about the sort of natural ways to be able to approach type 1 diabetes, which is a really challenging thing when you got a 7-year-old that hopefully has another 90 years to live. I mean, my grandfather lived to just shy of his 95th birthday with type 1 diabetes, being insulin dependent basically his entire life. And he lived a full life. He never lost a finger, never lost a toe. His vision was sharp. He was playing piano well into his 90s. The guy used to beat me at racquetball in his late 80s. Like, he was like poster child for how to survive with type 1 diabetes and really thrive in life. So that's what unfortunately my daughter never met him, but you know, that's the goal that we have, is for her to be able to live like that and have the fullest life possible. And we're exploring other options too. We may do stem cells, who knows, we're looking into it. But for right now, you know, we're on insulin like everybody else is with type 1 diabetes, and really managing the diet really, really well with a low carb approach. And just like you said, it is more than cut in half her insulin requirement, more than cut in half. And so she's doing pretty darn well. I could not have predicted how well she would bounce back. And she's like any other kid. She goes to school. She does all the things. She has her little, you know, special bandage over her CGM so it doesn't get ripped off when she's playing at recess and stuff like that. And she gets to pick the color, you know. Now there's like all different colors of these things that she can put on there. And it's really
accessorized. You know,
make it fun. Yeah. It's accessorized. Exactly.
Yeah. Girl after my own heart. That's right. That's right. It's fit and fabulous. You remember
that's
that.
Right.
Yes.
You gotta have the bling. Yes. You gotta have the bling. And the girls, they taught me that. I didn't know that with my four boys.
I love it. I love it. Okay. So let's shift a little bit. So we talked about, you know, kind of the first foundational thing being food that you eat. What are the other foundational principles for preventable?
Yeah. So FMSG. So the next one is movement. And you love to talk about this, as do I. Our bodies were meant to move. So any version of exercise, whatever it is, you can incorporate into your day. My favorite in my 40s has been walking. I never thought that I would take a walk and enjoy it because I was always like, I don't have time for that. You know, how can I take 30 minutes and go for a walk? Now that's my me time. That's where I get unplugged. I leave the cell phone at home. I take, you know, whatever might be distracting, I leave it and I just go for a walk. And so that's the thing I want people to know is that this exercise piece that maybe you and I were taught, you got to get 150 minutes of cardio every week. You got to do this. Got to be 5 days of this. It's so boring, right? All we talked about was boring cardio all the time. Like, forget that. Cardio is great, but I would focus more on just moving your body in any way that you can do daily. So whatever it is, you know, they ask me all the time, what's the best exercise, doc? Well, it's the one that you will do and do consistently each and every day. So for me, it might be just going surfing. That's my exercise. It might be going for a walk. It might be, you know, so there's snow outside right now. I'll probably go skiing today, you know, that kind of thing. And then during the day, the simple things we can do, this is going to be crazy, but this is completely unscripted because this was 6 o'clock in the morning when we started our call here. And I literally have weights at the base of my desk and we're talking, we're chatting. I can lift some weights. I'm standing right now. I can jump up and down. I have a standing desk and this is not my usual desk. I have one of those fancy ones in Hawaii that you could push the button and the thing goes, you know, you can raise and lower the thing. I don't have that here. I have literally, as my camera's shaking, an Amazon box on the regular desk and my computer on top of that. So converting your desk into a standing desk, most of us can do that. And if we can't tolerate standing the whole day, we'll just mix it up. Stand for an hour, then sit for an hour. And every 45 minutes or so, just move your body for 2 minutes. My favorite is I just drop down and I do a plank because I can only do that for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, you know? So that's it. Once an hour, if I do that, oh my gosh, the blood's flowing. I'm feeling like all tight in my abs. And I'm like, woo, something good must be happening, right? If we're feeling like our abs are tightening and we're like stressing a little bit, like, oh my gosh. But it can be really, really easy. So movement is the second primordial thing that we got to do in each and every day. And there's so many varieties. And I really focus now on the resistance training, the body weight stuff, something that incorporates our muscle, building muscle, because that is truly the key to longevity. And many of us, especially in medicine, we ignored that for way too long. We're like, oh, just do cardio. You know, do your cardio. Keep doing cardio, but you got to do some weights. You got to do, and it can be body weight. You don't have to have any physical weights. There's so much, the lunges, the planks, the burpees. My wife loves the burpee. I hate burpees. I'm never doing a burpee again.
Oh my God, bless her.
But there's so many different things you can do, even standing at your own desk. I can do air squats. So it can be really simple, no gym required. Just move your body every day, even if it's a simple walk. If you do that, say 10 minutes, 3 times a day, each time that you eat, walk for 10 minutes. Oh my gosh. Not only will it decrease the spike in glucose, of course, the blood sugar and the corresponding insulin, but you just feel better, right? You don't get that postprandial after, oh, I feel like I should take a nap right now. No way.
Yeah.
Go outside, get some fresh air for 10 minutes. You're ready to get back at it, get back to work. So it doesn't have to be complicated. You don't need a gym. Just move your body. It's that simple. So that's the next pillar.
Love that. What's the next one?
All right. So FMSG. So the first S I'm just going to put in there is sleep, because sleep is something you and I in the medical field, we undervalue, or at least we did for decades, right? When we trained in medical school and residency, it was like every hour that you sleep, you're missing something. you could be seeing this cool case that comes through the ER. You could be doing this cool procedure. Like, why would you want to sleep ever, right? I'll sleep when I'm dead. That was my mantra. You know, shout out to The Cure, any Cure fans out there from the 413 Dream album, Sleep When You're Dead. That was my mantra until maybe a decade ago when my wife was like, dude, you are so cranky. What does it matter with you? You come home from work and you're barking at the kids and you're, I was like, let me check. Oh, I was up at 4 o'clock this morning. It's now 9 o'clock at night. Duh, I'm not sleeping. Then I'm up catching up on, you know, the business of a household with six kids for the next couple hours and getting in bed at midnight and getting up at 4 or 5. Like, no wonder I was so cranky. I wasn't getting my sleep. And it's not just beauty sleep, though. It helps for that too. But for me, it was my mental state, my emotional health. It was a game changer once I started to appreciate and value sleep as the true superpower that we can all have. It's available to all of us. It's free. It doesn't take a lot. You know, maybe you got to buy some blackout shades. Maybe you got to buy some, you know, earplugs or something. If you live on an island where there's roosters crowing at all hours of the evening, like who said that roosters just crow in the morning? BS. They start crowing at like 11 p.m. So if I get into bed after 11, those things are crowing all night long right outside my window. So I often will sleep with earplugs. I have the blackout shades. You know, I got to have the climate controlled. I turn off all the lights and get rid of all the devices in the bedroom. So I do all the things. But I would say the easiest thing that we can all do today is just take a walk for 5 minutes in the morning in natural light outside. Have that sunlight hit your eyes. It's the best way to set you up for the perfect night's sleep. It gets that circadian rhythm in sync. You will sleep like a baby and it's free. Take a 5 minute walk every morning. Oh my gosh, game changer for me. So it's the simple things. I have a whole chapter on the book on it. But what for me changed is I had to appreciate it. I had to value it and recognizing the big difference that it made. Oh my gosh, I will never stop talking about how amazing sleep can be. And my wife thinks this is discovery because it was a discovery that happened probably too late in my life that sleep matters.
Yeah, it does. It's like you don't appreciate it when you're in your youth because you're just resilient to like sleeping for short amounts of time or you have the capability to sleep until noon, you know, if you stay up really late. But oh my gosh, I value my sleep, especially when babies get born at 2 to 3 a.m. I mean, through all the research, I have discovered that the 10 p.m., about 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. is like the most valuable window. Like if that gets disrupted, the next day is off. But I can do 6 to 7 hours and feel really good. Yeah.
Yeah. No, for me, my limit is I try to be always minimum 6 hours. I'll be honest, last night I looked at my little special watch here. It was 5 hours and 34 minutes, which it's not my, you know, best effort, but you know, sometimes life happens, right? And so I get it. We're all in different places, but if you can prioritize it at least, and then optimize the environment, make your bed, I call it the sleep cave, you know, the man cave. It's got to be dark. It's got to be cool. It's got to be, you know, it's got to be free of any distraction. Like literally my wife thinks I'm a Nazi with this. Like I put black tape over any emitting light source. Like my room is completely dark. She kind of hates it, but you know, the cool thing is she doesn't have to get up and pee like I do. You know, I'm turning 50 next year. I have to get up and pee at least once a night, sometimes twice a night. And it just sucks, but I have everything black. And in my house, I have these red night lights so they don't jack with my vision. They're not emitting blue light. I can jump right back into bed. And last night I had to get up, like I mentioned a couple times, because my daughter's monitor went off for a blood sugar issue. And I went back to sleep within probably a minute. I haven't checked my watch yet, but it'll tell you how quickly you can get back to sleep. And so even though it might be less than the proverbial 8 hours, do what works for you. But as you prioritize it, that becomes the most golden hours of the day. I really have to be honest. I never thought that I would say that. You know, I would always say, sleep is for the weak and sleep is for you sleep when you're dead. No, 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 no. Sleep is my superpower nowadays.
Love that. Okay. So food, movement, sleep.
FMSG. So the next one is gut health. And gut health, I'll be honest, in my book, the back half of the book is all about gut health because it's such a big topic. And it's one that you and I know for sure I didn't learn about in medical school, but it's just one of those things that's kind of up and coming. There's lots of new data. It's really exciting. I mean, it just, everything started to make sense. For example, with cravings, who knew that most of the cravings we have for junk food and highly processed, you know, ultra palatable foods came from our gut. And when we change our gut, it literally changes our life. Our cravings change. Like I mentioned earlier, I love ice cream. I used to eat ice cream every single night. It was either Haagen-Dazs or Ben & Jerry's. I'd sit down, I'd plop myself on the couch, turn on the TV, watch the surf. In Hawaii, we have a whole station dedicated to only surfing. It's called the Surf Channel. I would literally sit there every night, eat a bowl of ice cream. I did that for decades. And what I realized is when I focused on getting my gut healthy by eating lots of prebiotic, you know, hearty fibrous vegetables, the Brussels sprouts, the asparagus, all this cool stuff, and also incorporating probiotic foods, all the fermented kimchi, which is one of the Hawaiian delicacies. I mean, it's really Korean, but in Hawaii, we have so many varieties of kimchi, for example. I put all this stuff in my diet and my palate completely changed. I basically don't crave junk food ever. I know what it tastes like. So in my mind, if I see something really amazing, like my favorite ice cream, and it's at a party, yeah, I'll take a small serving of that, but I don't go back for seconds and all that kind of stuff. But it was night and day. My cravings just on a dime literally changed. And the cool thing is this stuff changes within a couple of days. I think the most recent study I looked at showed that within 72 hours, this gut bacteria, the gut flora, the so-called microbiota, can literally change. So you're not committed to a lifelong of cravings. And if you're having cravings, it's probably a gut thing. It's definitely not that you're weak. It's not that you can't, you know, mind over matter. It's none of that. It's the gut. You change the gut and you literally will change your life. So I get into it in the book. There's, I forget, 4 or 5 chapters about gut health. And the cool thing about it, just to keep it simple for this, is that every other aspect, whether it be the movement piece, the exercise, the sleep, the next thing we'll talk about real briefly is stress. That's sort of the final pillar. As we sort of get these things dialed in, really kind of tuned in, and we optimize them, all of this in turn affects our gut health. Like, who knew these guys in the dark, in our intestinal tract, who knew that they responded to a day-night circadian cycle? Well, guess what? They do. And so as we incorporate a really good circadian process where we're up during the day and it's bright outside, we go outside, get our daylight sunlight, and then at night, we kind of turn off the devices a couple hours before bed if we can, or my minimum is 1 hour because I'm like the rest of us, right? I'm freaking addicted to my phone. It's right here. It's close to me. I just have this thing handy, but I turn it off at night. And so it's the simple things that we do that will also help our gut flourish and be that best sort of co-creator with us, because these guys are our team. They are on our team. And if we build them up in the way that will be most beneficial for us, it also helps them. It's a symbiotic and synergistic relationship. It's so exciting. There's lots of data, but it is one of my favorite things to talk about, gut health.
I love that. I love that. And it'll be fascinating, I think, in the next 10 years to see, you know, what we discover. We're looking at fecal transplants. Literally, you can take the poop from somebody, put it inside another mouse, and that mouse suddenly gets skinny. You know, it's really incredible to see, you know, the influence that these bacteria have. And they're not just in our gut, right? They're in our mouth, which that's what populates our gut. I went to this conference this year. It's just a bunch of functional dentists. Yeah. And they were talking about how like heart disease starts in your mouth. Diabetes starts in your mouth. Alzheimer's starts in your mouth. It's like, wait, what? And then you start making these connections. I'm like, oh my gosh, this really makes sense. And so many different diseases. It's going to be fascinating to see, you know, what we discover. Well, we're going to shift to the last part of the podcast, which I like to call the semen analysis. And oh my gosh, there is this study circulating this week on erythritol. And you guys have all just been blasting me, Dr. Jamie, you actually all sent me like 3 other articles about how exercise causes heart disease, a twin study about how protein causes muscle loss. And so you guys, I had to flip a coin and walk on hot coals to figure out which one to pick for you all today. But you know, here's the thing that I just want to say before Dr. Hemingway and I give our real opinions. We have to be so cautious in this day and age about not only just reading headlines, but just like reading abstracts of studies. There is so many politics involved with our food supply. And if you are interested to dive in more, I'm going to have Nina on the podcast. But Nina Tekolz has been highly involved with the USDA. And had a great connection at Low Carb Denver here recently. I'm going to bring her on the podcast. But the corruption, not just within medicine, but within our food industry and our USDA guidelines, you know, you always have to look at the source fundings of these trials and really look at the actual studies themselves. And for a regular person, I think it's hard to read it and to pull those things out. Okay, so this study, of course, that like made headlines, it was in Nature Medicine, and it's titled The Artificial Sweetener, Erythritol, and Cardiovascular Risk. So, you know, obviously people transitioning to low-carb ketogenic diets, you know, sugar is evil, get away from sugar. Erythritol is one of those artificial sweeteners that is, you know, kind of on the safe list. So, you know, to really vilify this was a big deal, and I think why it was getting a lot of clicks. So they looked at these polyol sweeteners like erythritol and their incident 3-year risk for major adverse cardiovascular events. And you have to first understand this is a very, very small study. Once again, you can't just read the abstract. There's been a lot of people that have kind of torn this study apart. And so I just want to give you, you know, some of the highlights of that. First of all, our bodies make erythritol. So if something causes thrombosis and clotting, and it's something that our body makes, that would be, you know, something to think about. But our body actually synthesizes it in what we call endogenously through the pentose phosphate pathway. Production of it, erythritol from glucose, has been looked at. And in looking at type 2 diabetics that are consuming erythritol over 4 weeks, acute erythritol actually improved endothelial function. Okay, so now we have a study that says it causes platelet activation and thrombosis, but then we actually have a study in diabetics that shows that it actually improves endothelial function. Okay, so there's two things that don't agree. Also, in that exact same study, they looked at the vessel endothelial function and chronic treatment in aortic stiffness, which actually showed it decreased blood pressure. Okay, so another thing that shows that it actually may improve cardiovascular function. Erythritol has also been studied in both humans and animals for the oral microbiome and teeth health. One thing I discovered at this functional dentist conference, you guys, they are huge fans of xylitol. Xylitol for the oral microbiome. Basically the little bacteria in your mouth think it's a carb, think it's a sugar, and they eat it and they die. And it was amazing. There's people like throwing xylitol gum and lollipops around. And but with erythritol, they find a similar effect. It acts as an antioxidant within the mouth and can improve the oral microbiome. So I think that we have to take all of these things, you know, with a grain of salt or a grain of sugar. when we look at these studies and we look at these headlines, and we have to use our brains and say, does this make sense, right? Because if you tell people not to eat something, this is one of my, and I'm going to let you weigh in here, Thomas, in a second. When we say, you know, eat a plant-based diet, don't eat meat, it causes cancer. Don't eat eggs, they have too much cholesterol. Now don't eat erythritol. When we vilify something, we always have to say what is going to be replaced with that in the diet. If somebody pulls something out of their diet, something has to replace that because we have to eat. So if you pull red meat out of the diet, you're pulling out a very nutrient-dense food, you're pulling out a very good protein source, right? If you say, okay, don't eat erythritol, okay, then what are they going to do? They're going to look for a different artificial sweetener, which, you know, some of them have some sketchy data around them too. You know, ask people about sucralose or any other artificial sweetener. Okay, don't eat any artificial sweeteners. Okay, how about the natural sugars? Okay, now they're just going to eat loads of, you know, okay, real sugar or organic sugar. That's what I love when it sounds like organic cane sugar. Okay, it's the same. But that's always my concern is, you know, when you push some sort of agenda within a patient's diet and you're asking them to remove something major, it's going to be replaced with something. And sometimes it's necessary, right? If they have an allergy or lactose intolerance, but we always have to, you know, understand that it's going to get replaced. So I don't know what your thoughts are.
Exactly that. And I think Nina Teicholz would be very proud because her sort of initial big breakthrough was on fat, right? We were all, I think you and I brought up in the same era where fat was the enemy. Like, holy crap, like never eat fat, especially not butter, like not the real fat. Oh my gosh, like that's terrible for you. You're going to die of a heart attack. I mean, Ansel Keys said that was the way that it was. Like, we all know that data was very much cherry picked and very much skewed. And so here's the deal with data. You can skew data to prove any point that you want. You know, the vegans got their data. The carnivores got their data. Everybody's got their data to support it. Dr. Google is my favorite, right? My patients come to me and say, hey, look what I learned. And I'm like, oh, did you get that from Dr. Google? Like, Google is amazing, but there's so much noise out there. There's so much garbage, and the data is only as good as the study itself. And in this study in Nature, it quotes a couple of different studies. One of them had an N of eight participants, like eight. One, two, three. That's like my family. They did that study just in my family. Like, that's small. And they're putting it in this giant. And I got to be honest, like, for me, it was a little disappointing because Nature is kind of like the Harvard of journals. Yeah. Like, it's like the journal everybody looks to. Nature and Science, those two, right? And this was in Nature. And so here's the thing. You can spin any data any way you want. And I'm with you. I'm like, well, if we do this, then what are we going to be replacing it with? You know, is it the bags of pure cane sugar from Hawaii? You know, hey, shout out to CNH, right? But highly processed, you know, garbage sugar. Like, I go to honey myself personally and maple syrup. Those are my two main sweeteners. I do stevia in some things as well. Stevia is a little harder if you're trying to bake with it. Like, I'm just going to be honest, it's not that easy to figure out, you know? So I definitely look to these natural alternatives. My go-to are maple syrup, honey, and stevia. And do I have some products with erythritol? Yes. Do they make up the majority of my diet? No. And everything you have to look at with this lens, exactly like you said, is what are we going to replace it with? Are we just going to replace it with highly processed sugar? Are we going to replace it like with the whole fat conundrum? We replaced all these healthy fats we used to eat. Like, the original McDonald's, who knew they actually used animal fat? They fried up their French fries in animal fat. And that would have been way better than the seed oils that they use today, that they literally never changed the hopper there. Like, it's crazy when we villainize something, something else takes its place. And guess what did? Carbohydrates, right? We eat so many carbohydrates, all the fake fats, the hydrogenated oils, and we are literally the least healthy from the advent of that time change when we decided fat was the enemy. And we were wrong. We were completely wrong. So I'm like you, I have to look at it with sort of this broader lens of not only what we will replace it with, but what have we been doing for millennia? And yes, we do have erythritol in our body. So is that going to kill us? Probably not. But as we say, the dose makes the poison, right? If you're eating, you know, grams and kilograms of this stuff, like we do sugar, the sugar is going to kill us. Like, we eat 100, almost 50 pounds of sugar in the standard Western American diet annually. That is way too much sugar. Should we be eating that much erythritol? Well, we wouldn't have to, right? Because it's such a more potent, you know, substance. And so you wouldn't have to eat that much. But yeah, for me, it doesn't really change anything because there's just so much, you know, that there's noise in this study, but it does give me a second. Like, I actually looked at a couple of my daughter's like keto treats to see if I was just kind of curious, like which ones had erythritol, which ones didn't. And I'll be honest, I might use that a little bit more. I'm not going to like never have it again. I doubt it, but I always go to the natural things first, the maple, you know, the honey and stevia. Those are my go-to three because there's lots of data, you know, adverse data on sucralose, on aspartame, on all these other, you know, chemical sweeteners. And erythritol, I think, is among the better of the so-called artificial sweeteners, if you will. And so, yeah, is this game changer for me? No. But does it cause me to look a little bit deeper? Yes. And just makes me even happier that my choices have been the maple and the honey and things like that is my go-to. And so, yeah, I don't think you can go wrong when you know, look with that lens.
Yeah, same with our family. We'll use some raw honey or natural maple. I tend to like monk fruit or allulose a little bit better when it comes to the stevia. It does have kind of a potent, bitter taste to me, and erythritol, of course, because the sugar alcohol has kind of that cooling effect. So, but once again, I mean, who's eating these things, you know, like super regularly? Well, this has been so wonderful, Thomas. Tell people when your book comes out. We don't have an exact date, but where they can find it, where they can find your work. I know you have courses and things like that too.
Yeah. So easiest place to find me is my website, thomashemingway.com, and on Instagram, drthomashemingway, Dr. Thomas Hemingway. And the book will be out right before summer. I don't have an exact date. We've pushed a lot of things. I'm getting the proof here real soon, but you can actually pre-order today if you either hop on over there to my website, thomashemingway.com or thepreventablebook.com. It can be pre-ordered today and you get some bonuses if you do pre-order. You actually get a course that I put together and that's going to be released pretty soon in the next couple of weeks. And so you get some stuff even before the book comes out, which is pretty cool. And the book, of course, is called Preventable: 5 Powerful Practices to Avoid Disease and Build Unshakable Health. And the other place you can find me is where you were recently on my podcast, which is also now called Unshakable Health. And all podcast platforms will have it. So would love to see you over there. And so much love to everyone. This is just something I love to do, to talk about how we can not only get healthy, be healthy, but truly to thrive in our life, not just simply survive, which is what I was doing for decades. And it's so much more fun to be thriving. So if you want to thrive, come join us. Hop on over there to thomashemingway.com to see all the goodies. And I'd love to see you. Thanks again,
Jamie. Wonderful. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.